We're now going to speak to our overseas correspondent, Mohammed Ali Harisi. He's going to take us through the recently announced ceasefire. A UN Special Envoy Hans Grundberg announced the two-month truce earlier this week. In fact, the deal came in effect on Saturday, the first day of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The deal was struck between the Saudi-led coalition and the Iran-based Houthi rebels. Joining me now on the line from Dubai as AFP's Deputy Bureau Chief for the Gulf and Yemen is Mohammed. Ramadan Kareem, Mohammed.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. Tell me, is there an extra significance or a hope attached to the ceasefire lasting, given that it began on the first day of Ramadan?
Absolutely. It's the first nationwide ceasefire since the conflict erupted in 2014. It's the biggest ceasefire since then, and I think it brings some hope for the Yemenis who are struggling every day to stay alive. It's an indication that maybe the warring parties are ready now to sit at a table and talk about ending this conflict that has killed more than 377,000 people in a direct or an indirect way.
Yeah, it is one of the biggest humanitarian disasters in modern history. Before we talk about some of the impact for Yemeni on the ground, this isn't the first ceasefire in this ongoing conflict, and they haven't lasted long. So how is this one faring less than a week in?
The previous ceasefires, they were mostly located or limited to some areas in Yemen. But this is the biggest ceasefire yet that includes all major or all the Yemeni land. Less than a week from the beginning of the truce, there has been little violations, but it has been widely respected. And as the UN envoy, yesterday he held a press conference and he said that the truce has reduced violence in Yemen. He's still worried about little violations here and there, but we can say that it's still respected. Yemenis, to be honest, are not too hopeful because the previous ceasefires escalated quickly and turned into violence again. But this time, it seems like there's some kind of a political decision to keep the truce in its place as long as possible.
What do you think is the change, Mohammed?
There are a lot of changes in the region. Mainly it's geopolitical changes. Like, for example, there is the nuclear deal with Iran, which is about to be achieved. And as we know, the Houthis are loyal to Iran, are supported by Tehran. So it might be some kind of a card at the negotiation table. Also, the humanitarian crisis has reached unprecedented levels, and many millions of people are on the brink of famine. And this is one more factor that puts more pressure on the warring sides. Also, there is one third factor, which is also geopolitical. Saudi is looking to turning the page on this war. And as Saudi pressures its allies in Yemen to end the war, there must be some kind of truce. And this is what happened a few days ago.
Mohammed, can you give us some background into what sparked the conflict? How is it that that Yemen is in a situation where it is essentially two other nation states fighting on their land, and you know, citizens or Yemeni citizens themselves are caught in this fight? We have, as you said, a Saudi element and the Iran-backed Houthi.
Thank you so much. This is an excellent question, but I'll need like an hour to answer it, but I'll try to be as brief as possible. It's really complicated. It's like Lebanese politics now, you know, you never know who is with whom. But the conflict started in 2014 when the Houthi rebels marched from a town named Amran during the summer towards Sana'a. They had some issues with the government. They were accusing the government of marginalizing them because they belong to a minority called the Zaydis. And once they reach the doors of Sana'a, they somehow managed to infiltrate it and enter the capital. And they held control of major government buildings. And that's when the ex-president, who was killed by the Houthis later, Ali Abdullah Saleh, realized that he lost power, and he struck a deal with the Houthis to let them hold the keys of the capital. Once they were in the capital, they felt that there was a momentum, and they continued to invade other parts of Yemen. While the Houthis were invading other parts of Yemen, Saudi was preparing to strike back, because Saudis are loyal to Tehran, and Saudi will never, because the Houthis are loyal to Tehran, and Saudi find it really, it's not possible to let Tehran loyalists be at its border, because Yemen is the neighboring Saudi Arabia. And that's when Saudis started its intervention and managed to stop the advances of the Houthis. But it was a little bit too late, because the rebels took control of large places in Yemen, especially in the north and in the western side. And since then, the conflict escalated. Both parties, the government supported by Saudi and the Houthis supported by Iran, were fighting to capture a place or lose another. And this conflict over who controls what turned also into a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
I was wondering that. Mohammed Ali Harisi is the AFP Deputy Bureau Chief for the Gulf in Yemen, and is talking us through the current conflict, or the ceasefire in Yemen, which is on the back of a 6 or 7 year conflict on that territory. I wonder, I'm just curious to know, Mohammed, as often with, conflict in African nations or North African nations, these hark back to tribal alliances or how borders have been drawn by colonizing forces that have not aligned with tribal or nomadic populations. Do we have a history like this in Yemen? Is that part of the background, or is that not the case here?
I can say that Yemen is, for a long period of time, Yemen was governed by tribes, and the tribes in Yemen are really, really powerful. But the Arab Spring in 2011, it changed the balance of power in Yemen and made civil servants even more powerful than tribes. And this was a major shift in the political scene in Yemen. So when the Arab Spring started and there was demonstrations on the street, demanding more democracy, and there was a regime change when Ali Abdullah Saleh left and Hadi then took over, it was a major turnover for Yemen, which put pressure on the tribes to ease their hand over the governing regime, and that's when the balance of power shifted.
What is the truce?
Yeah, right. What I can say, yeah.
Right. What does the truce actually mean for the average person in Yemen? I know it's not just the conflict and the shelling that's going on. We've got a humanitarian crisis on another level of food security, the availability of water and water usage, and as well as just basic services collapsing or inability to have basic health care. Can you take us through that?
I can give you two examples. For example, imagine yourself sitting in a city that it's continuously bombed, for example, and whenever you have to leave to work in the morning, you get into your car, you drive to another place to get to work or earn your salary, and then suddenly there is a bomb hitting the road next to you. But now you can just, you know, turn the engine and drive safely and go to work. Of course, everyone is afraid that it might fall apart at any second. But until now, it's upholding and people can go to work safely. This is one. Two, before the truce, the coalition was holding ships in the sea, ships loaded with fuel. So there was a big fuel crisis in Yemen, especially in the territories governed by the Houthis. Once the truce went into effect, two or three, maybe, sorry, yesterday he mentioned, the UN Info mentioned four tankers loaded with fuel, very necessary for hospitals to work, for clinics, for schools, for cars, for vehicles, have been allowed to enter the Hodeidah port and release the fuel. And these are two examples of how the truce can make the life of Yemenis a little bit much better than it is.
So will this mean food and water will finally reach the populations in Yemen that are starving?
Because no.
This has been one of the concerns of the UN and other humanitarian organizations, hasn't it?
Yeah, but it's really not related to this. It's mainly about the fuel. The goods are really related to how the people can buy these goods. The problem with Yemen famine is that there is enough food and there are enough goods in Yemen, but people buy food because they cannot afford them, because there's many people lost their jobs, many people are living in tents, many people have not earned their salaries in 4 or 5 years, like the teachers in schools, for example. And that's why there is a problem. So the problem is not finding food in Yemen. The problem is buying the food in Yemen.
And what is the impact for, you know, a generation and a half? We have children who've grown up in this conflict, in the lifetime of this conflict, as well as children, younger children as well. What impact are we going to see on the next generation of Yemeni?
I can tell you that, for example, since the beginning of the war, more than 2,000 schools have been destroyed or damaged or turned into a military camp or a refugees camp. And so millions of or tens of thousands of kids have lost their ability to be educated, the ability to be educated. On top of that, there are millions who are staying out of school because they don't have homes and they are away from cities where there are actually schools, and they're living in rural areas and mountains, escaping the wars. There is also a third major factor, which is that thousands of kids have been recruited to fight in the war, and many, many of those have been killed over the years. According to the UNICEF, I guess 2,400 or 500 kids have been killed since the beginning of the war.
Mohammed, just quickly, I saw on your Twitter you shared a story of a Yemeni student studying in Ukraine who's been caught up in both conflicts.
Mazen.
Yes. Yeah. Where is he now? Could you just take us through very quickly his journey and where he is now?
Yeah. Mazen's story is similar to stories to many Yemenis. It's called the Yemeni curse. You struggle to leave your country, and once you reach somewhere else, you face another problem. Mazen's struggle is really, it's the struggle of every Yemeni. So he tried to escape Sana'a in 2016 once his father realized that he might be recruited to fight with the rebels. He drove for like 2-3 days until he reached Oman. And once he reached Oman, he was able to get a visa and go to Russia. In Russia, they deported him because his papers weren't really, there was some problem with his papers. So he went back to Egypt, then Sudan, then applied again and went to Ukraine. In Ukraine, he was able to find a stable life, to pursue his education. But 2 months before he was about to graduate, the war broke and he had to leave Odessa. It wasn't easy at all because he had to drive with his friends for 950 kilometers in a car, in a taxi, then stop at a long queue and walk for like 50 kilometers under the snow, spend 4 or 5 days at the borders with Poland and cross there. Right now, he is in Germany. He's in a small refugee camp. It's not a camp. It's staying in a school, I guess. And he's just waiting to know where he will be going next. He hopes he can go back to Odessa one day, and he hopes he can finish his studies.
Mohammed Ali Harisi, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope we can catch up with better news as the Yemeni ceasefire progresses.